three-dimensional transforming musical linguistic objects.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Now, today's podcast begins my 20th year of podcasting from here in the salon. And I want to thank you for being here with me because, well, if it wasn't for you, I still wouldn't be doing these podcasts. And appropriately, I'll begin with another talk by Terence McKenna. A friend of mine gave me some old tapes that he had, and he told me that Terence gave this same talk, or at least one that is very similar, on more than one occasion. So hopefully I haven't already podcasted. As you know, I've done that at least once before, but hey, there are over 300 McKenna talks here in the salon, so it's easy, for me at least, to make a mistake like that. In any event, it's always fun to listen to Terence, even if we've heard it before. And since we are at the beginning of a new season of the salon's podcasts, I'm going to do something different. In deference to those among us who would rather not listen to my long introductions, well, I'm going to skip right to the talk. So here's Terence.
I loved what you said about, is it all right to feeling restless with psychedelics? It reminds me of a story that a friend of mine told me recently. His father, this is a man 40 years old, a psychotherapist. His father said to him, I want to ask you a question, a very serious question. But before I ask this question, I want you to understand that the answer to this question is no. Okay? So the answer to this question is no. It's very important to me that I ask you this question. I said, okay. I said, what's the question? I said, the question is, have you ever used drugs? No, thank you. I feel very relieved. But still, having done these things for now nearly 10 years with greater and lesser frequency and thinking about it, I do see that it changes and it deepens. And what it seems to do is to encompass more and more. I don't know whether that's because all this raving about creating an alternative language or an alternative vocabulary of description is actually beginning to happen and to feed back upon itself. But to my mind, the issue of psychedelics in society has been steadily changing and transmuting itself over the past 10 or 15 years. And very independently of what's going on with the so-called drug problem, which is a whole other set of issues of the schizophrenia of institutions, the way in which institutions are habituated to various kinds of activity, such as making money. The psychedelic phenomenon as a part of the drug phenomenon is probably 5 or 6% of what is going on in terms of money made. I'm sure it's even less. It's nothing. It just is not a factor. And yet the psychedelics are always included as part of the scourge that is sweeping over mankind. I think that there is a drug problem and that there is not going to be a solution until there's an honest rethinking of not only what these things are doing to society, but we are being asked by the culture crisis generally to revision our relationship to the planet and to the cultural fate that we appear to be set up for as a legacy of our historical antecedents. We're being asked to revision exactly what we think nature is. Nature, as we inherit it out of our tradition, is just something to be pillaged and used. It's a resource, and it's to be mined, cut down, and sold as an object of commerce. The psychedelics have, I think, over the past 15 years or so, taken on this strange ecological resonance, if you want. In the 1960s, when people were taking LSD, it was presented basically as instant psychotherapy. It was about getting into yourself, recovering traumatic material, and it was also sort of represented as an aesthetic aphrodisiac or something. You would take low doses and look at paintings by Hieronymus Bosch and Van Gogh and have an insight into art, which to some degree this was true. But what was absent from that whole view of the psychedelic experience was any realization that it came out of nature, that it was a statement about the beauty resident in nature, in the same way that an abalone shell or a tropical butterfly or a sea anemone is a statement about the order and beauty that is in nature. The reason this was not apparent in the first wave of the psychedelic research was because LSD was the paradigm compound. But the reason LSD was in that role was simply that it was very easy to make a lot of it, so that it was available for research. This is a consideration when we forget that, because we live in an era of restricted drug research where for a researcher to possess 1,000 grams of a compound is a lot. But when serious research is done, a lot of the experimental compound is needed, and LSD fell into that category. But this, to my mind, postponed the realization that the psychedelic experience is primarily an aesthetic experience in the same category as windsurfing, climbing high mountains, scuba diving, going to the Amazon jungle or the Great Barrier Reef or that sort of thing. In other words, it's an inspection of nature, of natural beauty. There is the psycholytic function, the dissolving of neuroses and the opening to connection to other people and all the things which excited the therapists. But I think beyond that, in the so-called transpersonal realm, when you analyze the content of the transpersonal experience as delivered by plant psychedelics, it is inevitably this Gaia-like affirmation of the fertility and fecundity and mutually reinforcing stability and ongoingness of the living world. Light is a theme which is prevalent in all cultures, and the great Western thrust toward the definition of monotheism and ethical constancy and the notion of the union, the possibility of the union of divinity with the individual human expression, all of this can be traced back or takes great energy from the Iranian light religions that flourished in Central Asia in the fourth millennia. And in the Amazon, light is associated with sexual energy and fecundity and power, the magical objects that are moved through hyperspace, whatever that means, through the psychedelic mind space, are objects made of light. Light is something we invoke whenever we strive to express the notion of well-intended communications. Then we say, he made himself clear, she painted a picture, I see what you mean. So light is somehow sensed by us as an ideal. We can even talk about physical light. Light is made of photons. If you know anything about the physics of elementary particles, you know that the photon is the only particle without an antiparticle. It is somehow unitary within itself. It doesn't require its antithesis in order to come into existence. And I think it's possible to take very seriously. Some of you are familiar, and we will touch on all these things in more detail. I'm just flashing the cards before your eyes. But the tradition of the circulation of the light that is so highly developed in Taoist yoga, circulation of the light and the building of a light body as a vehicle to use to travel in across the dangerous transition area between life and death and then into some kind of immortal realm. What has always fascinated me personally about the psychedelic experience has been the hallucinations. I mean, in my book, it just doesn't make it if there aren't hallucinations. And people argue this and say, well, you have wonderful realizations, tremendous feelings, openings of the heart. Yes, all, yes. But there is something about this visionary function because it is information that is so pregnant with the intent of being apprehended that it chooses to organize itself into the visual field. You know, it can't be held back. It chooses to manifest itself. And it is a stunning affirmation of what? I'm not sure. I mean, that's, I guess, what our lives' compass is about. It's a stunning affirmation of the presence of alien beauty, at least within reach of the human mind. I mean, I don't want to say in the human mind, because we're not sure that it's in the human mind. Some of this stuff is so peculiar that you only believe it's in the human mind because that's the simplest hypothesis. But it isn't necessarily the one that springs immediately to intuition. Sometimes the hypothesis which springs immediately to intuition is, this could not possibly be the product of my mind or the mind of any other human being because it is so peculiar. But the vocabulary for dealing with hallucination is, if anything, even more impoverished than our vocabulary for dealing with emotion. I sort of use hallucination as a general term for a group of phenomena which become progressively more three-dimensional and real. In other words, what some people mean by hallucination is, we could all just do an exercise here where you press lightly, but press on your eyes, and you will see labyrinthine-like patterns of chartreuse light, or in some cases lavender light organized in a kind of maze-like pattern. Those are called phosphenes and are actually the result of physical pressure related into the chemistry of the eye. Yeah.
I have a better problem with the word hallucination, too. I prefer like the word visions or visual images because hallucination means seeing something that's not really there. Yeah.
Well, let me develop it here because at the end I agree with you. So you start out with these things, the phosphenes. Yeah. Then you get what are called hypnagogia. Hypnagogia are trivial. Dancing mice, little candies, autumn leaves, I mean, straws, stuff. And it seems to have, I mean, I suppose one could psychoanalyze it, but who wants to bother? The main thing that typifies hypnagogia is its lack of engaging content for the person experiencing it. It is inevitably trivial. But at some point, the hypnagogia gives way to something that is more demanding and more present. And it comes like a wave in my experience. And it is sometimes begins as a thought which ends as a picture without ever crossing over an actual moment of transition. But in any case, this is vision. Now you're playing in the major leagues. This is what William Blake was talking about. This is not where you see geometric shapes and shifting fields of color, but you see, you know, Stygian lakes and shattered ruins of alien civilizations and bizarre vegetable machine forms that are transforming themselves. And the key concept here is information. Everything, this is real stuff. It has history. It has a future. It has some kind of relation to the other objects in its world. And this is it's this place that I call truly psychedelic. It's this place that I strive to attend to every time I take a psychedelic. It's possible to have a fairly deep involvement with psychedelics and actually never have experienced this. And I'm not sure why that is. I think it has to do with fear of, number one, taking sufficient amount of the substance, then fear of creating the environment where the substance can fully expose itself, because the environment in which to meet it is silent darkness. And people, you know, go bowling, they go out to see a movie, they watch David Letterman. I mean, it's true. I mean, we've given workshops where it was specifically to be about psilocybin or something like that. And first question off the bat is, will I be able to drive? In all senses, you will not be able to drive. And you can't even have a friend drive either. Just forget that. So, and this vision stuff, really, I never really got it with LSD. The only way I could have the kind of experience that I wanted with LSD was to smoke a lot of very good hash with it. And then there seemed to be like a clash or a synergy that would set up a standing wave in the visual cortex, who knows where. But anyway, then suddenly there would be outlandish data in the visual field. And with the what I call the true psychedelics is actually a very limited field, a very limited family of drugs, these tryptamine drugs, psilocybin, DMT, 5-methoxy-DMT, and then the combinations of these with MAO inhibitors. But it's, now, the thing which distinguishes this family is that they are very closely related to normal brain metabolism. They all occur in plants, and they all have a history of shamanic usage already established somewhere in the world. So though in some corners my reputation is that of a wild man who says, you know, you should take anything to get high, actually it's not true. I'm an extremely conservative person advocating that this small family, which includes DMT and the mushrooms and so forth, be examined as a separate phenomenon, really. The whole thing which contaminates all discussions at every level of the drug issue is the fact that we should just get rid of the word drug because it's too broad. It means too many things. I mean, there are drug opportunities available to society as well as drug problems. You know, you have to name the drug you're talking about rather than just run around with this kind of Chicken Little attitude toward what is going on. Yeah, Robert.
I don't know whether you want to get into this issue sometime later on, but it's related to the question of hallucinations. And a question that I have is trying to determine when a vision is a source of external information versus, quote, simply a internal reaction of the body. That is the analogy being that normally we see outside when it's light outside and not much on the inside, and that the use of a psychedelic is turning the light on in the inside, and what we're really getting is a mirror reflection, and that all of this is really the phosphine thing at a higher level, and therefore instances such as near-death experiences when you see something, these are very common among people. So to what, how do you, or do we want to delay this question, how, on what evidence do we have that this is an external plant-mediated intelligence of some sort?
Well, this is a real problem. You would think we would, it's almost like a Sufi a conundrum of some sort. I mean, you would think we would be able to figure it out. It's, imagine you go into a bar and sit down at a table, and a few minutes later someone comes in and sits next to you, and they lean across the table and say, I'm an extraterrestrial. Now, you should be able then to have a conversation with them, at the end of which you are satisfied that they either are or are not telling the truth, because of the quality of your questioning should elicit the truth in this matter. The fact is, it's bloody hard to tell, and that it raises the most profound questions of self and world, of language and identity, of meaning and intent, because ultimately what it exposes is that we don't know what we are. And not knowing who we are not able to tell who anybody else is. So it pushes us to a new effort at self-definition. I don't know. This is interesting to me. It's interesting that it's such a persistent problem, and that you basically, it's a religious matter. You decide, well, it's a product of psyche. It's in the psyche. Or you decide it isn't. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter, because the truth about the psychedelic experience, from my point of view, is it is, if it is not an extraterrestrial, then extraterrestrials have to take second place to whatever it is. It is not necessary to name it in order to grapple with it. It is, without a doubt, the most unlikely and the strangest object in the human universe. I mean, we just don't know what to make of it. Because it operates on us personally. You know, I mean, quarks are strange, but who has ever seen one? And, you know, certain things are going on in, I don't know, topology or somewhere. I mean, there are odd corners of the universe. But the psychedelic experience is available to anyone, and it's utterly confounding of the assumptions of the world in which we're living. Now, it's possible to go from birth to death without ever having a psychedelic experience, or maybe you get it at death. But in other words, it's possible to live your life in utter blissful ignorance of the fact that your body is capable of delivering you into a place 100% different than reality. Well, that's big news, I would think. And, you know, why then are we in this funny position of not wanting to hear about this? Or of some of us being impassioned to spread the word about it and others not wanting to hear about it? What's going on here? How much monkey politics is operating around the issue of the fact that there are doorways in nature into other dimensions? I mean, you can argue, well, what do you mean by dimension? But the fact of the matter is, utter transcendent mysteries that when you stand in the face of them, No matter who you are, you can't fail to be awestruck and moved. Well, I guess what's amazing to me about that is I assumed growing up, I was raised Catholic and inculcated into a 2,000-year-old, utterly dead religion where, you know, maybe Thomas Merton was getting off, but I wasn't getting off. And the rational faith was scientific realism backed up by pragmatism and materialism. And the basic message was there is no magic. There is no magic. You know, you're in childhood and this is the last magic you'll ever know. Well, the psychedelics say, you know, there's more magic than you can handle. That you are going to have to choose to turn your face away from magic because it's there in this one confined area. Now, I don't know what's going on with Babaji and the Roshis and the Rishis, and I suspect that what's going on is they're still spinning the bicycle wheel that was set going by Soma and Teanonacatl and sacramental plants in use millennia ago. I am a maverick in that I'm not at all into the idea that there's a lineage and that you should sweep my front porch for 10 years and then I'll turn you on to something far out. It seems to me much better to tell all the secrets, to admit that nobody's holding any aces, nobody has figured it out yet, and we need to look at the cards that are on the table and act from that. And when you do that, I think you find yourself involved in music. I certainly wish I was more involved in music, in the psychedelic experience, in cultivating yourself as a lover for somebody else, in art. In other words, in immediate experience, not buying these guiding images that are being impressed upon us from above by Madison Avenue and television and so forth and so on. They need to view us as an atomic system, meaning as millions of interchangeable small parts, because that's the perfect kind of customer. But that's an inhuman definition of what we are. That's an institutional definition. Good for the institution, bad for us as people. What we need to recognize is that that is just a fiction of the capitalist system. And what we really are is extremely unique expressions of a mystery even greater than ourselves, so that we are like, if you will, tiny fractal buds off the main body of the fractal mystery. All of the mystery comes together in us. The mystery of mind, the mystery of the union of the past to the future in a kind of ever-changing but always stable and defining present. In the mystery of communication, what is that? How can that happen? Through language. All of these things that are truly compelling and truly mysterious come tangential in the human heart and the human mind. So that means you don't have to go to the National Laboratory at Brookhaven or the South Pole or the moon to explore an edge or a frontier. The major edge is the edge of the human spirit, and we each have a piece of that action. So it's very hard, if you see things that way, to then not see the psychedelics as being something that you bring on into the arena of your life. Your life is an arena of risk and opportunity. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. You know, the goal of life is not to get through it. Some people seem to have that approach. What they spend their life doing is arranging things so that the deathbed scene is perfect. The bed is huge. The family is gathered. The estates are manicured in all directions. And, you know, and then you just give your few final observations and that's it. You know, it's many people think this way. It's an arena of risk and opportunity, and I say, I don't know how much you could win if you got on a roll. You know, you might be able to parlay a win that would carry all of us right into some other kind of world. It's really up for grabs. The main thing, I think, that draws people to this rap and to the psychedelics in their own life when they interpret it anywhere close to these ideas is it's permission for hope. It's a wild card. It says you don't know what is actually going on, and that means that there may be opportunities for miracles. It seems like there are opportunities for miracles. So it legitimates a kind of hope that all these other models of the world are running against. I often think of what Robert Anton Wilson said about power elites. He said, I define the power elite as myself and my friends. If I didn't define the power elite as myself and my friends, I'd be living in a loser's scenario. Who wants to be a loser? And I think what people who are involved in these kinds of considerations know is that the bottom line here is magic, that the evolution of the historical future is up for grabs. There is a curious law operating which says that the best vision of the future will win. I really believe this, that beauty is what rises to the surface, that in the so-called competition of the paradigms and the search for a new world order, it's the person who's going to tell the best story who's going to carry us all along into this future. And it behooves each of us then to give it our best shot. These are what are called memes. You can think of them as viruses. They are linguistic structures which make their way out into society and compete against other memes in a process of, in some cases, natural selection, in other cases, symbiotic reinforcement, but as a mirror image of what goes on in the biological world. And what I've seen is that there is so much beauty in the psychedelic experience when you get it sliced right and coming at you just perfectly tuned, that I'm sure it will win. I'm sure that somehow the best story that can be told will have the psychedelic experience set in it like a jewel. Yeah.
When you were pointing out a group of tryptamine drugs, DMT, psilocybin, do you not consider LSD to be part of that? Doesn't LSD have a tryptamine structure?
Well, LSD is sort of a special case. It's sort of half in and half out of the natural world. LSD occurs in morning glories and in Asian families of woodrose-like plants. But the LSD which Hoffman discovered was isolated from a fungus, an ergot-dwelling smut, which isn't to put it down. It's just that's what it's called. Smuts, slimes, and something else in that family. But we shouldn't malign the slimes. Never malign a slime, because they're a wonderful example of how organisms can evolve themselves into collectivities. LSD is, I think, sort of in a special category. There are special categories, you know, other special categories. For instance, some of you may know about Datura, tropane alkaloids. These occur in Datura, Jimson weed, the arborescent Daturas that are horticulturally sold as landscaping and are used in shamanism in South America and are very strong mind-altering compounds, but not interesting to me. They are more like delirium, and there's a forgetting of what goes on that's troubling. People have different intentions with these things. For instance, you probably all know the work of Stan Grof. Well, LSD was wonderful for Stan's work because it really, I think, accentuates the power to recover traumatic material, the power to be present with your own memories and your own breathing, and that sort of thing. The tryptamines that interest me are sort of beyond the problem of the neurotic personality. You know, Jung had this notion that psychic health was something that went on till the day you died, that what individuation meant was continuous growth and transcendence, and that it isn't that there is neurotic and psychotic and then we're healthy. It's no, that of course you're not psychotic, of course you're not neurotic. What you want to be is ever self-transcending and growing, and this is the task of a lifetime. It never ends, and you have to constantly keep fine-tuning it and examining your motives and how you're being in the world. And the tryptamines seem to be the real shamanic, if you will, or adventuring, if you will, or exploring. Therefore, I think people who have made major strides in their personal process before ever coming to that. But it's obvious, you see, that in traditional societies there is shamanism as an institution to lead people to these things, to promote a professional class of voyagers into the unconscious, into hyperspace, to steady the society. We have fallen so far from that that we're in the position of having literally each one of us to reinvent the wheel. That's why I think these kinds of gatherings are so radical, because we not only give each other permission to do what we're doing, but we also can exchange techniques, lore, data, connections, and thereby solve everybody's problem, whatever everybody's problem is, and facilitate going forward. Yeah.
I'd like to, maybe not right now, but discuss cannabis and for me, it's been like extremely, I've just had incredible breakthroughs and understandings, and just it's been amazing, just with very small amounts of grass, you know. And is it considered it's not a psychedelic, actually, is it? I mean, what is it?
Well, it's in a funny class. It's a polyhydric alcohol. Yes, it's funny that grass is, even though we teach these things and psychedelics always come up, it's sometimes hours can go by without talking about cannabis. However, hours cannot go by without smoking cannabis.
Is it considered a psychedelic?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's considered that it has a psychedelic effect. It's definitely a psychedelic. I mean, ask anybody who's eaten 2 or 3 grams of hash. Ask people who make cookies that cause people to need oxygen tanks. I mean... Yes, I should be the first person to praise the virtues of cannabis, because I sometimes feel that I'm unfaithful to her by not talking more about it. I was what was known as a nervous child until I was about 18 years old. I stammered a lot, that now, that bit that you get in left-wing radical. And then I smoked some grass and I realized, my God, I can self-medicate myself into mental health. I can be like everybody else. And I have been ever since. And much of my motivation for going to the East was to be where there was plenty of hash. Hash seemed to be really the thing. And, you know, if you've ever looked into it and read the 19th century literature on hashish, it was clearly their LSD. In the first place, they didn't smoke it. They ate jellied tinctures that they describe as being like emerald green jello. I mean, it must have just been unbelievable, this stuff, you know. And the Club de Hashashin would get together, Baudelaire and Durier and all these people, and eat this stuff. And their descriptions, you know, nobody could write those kind of descriptions unless they were just smashed out of their mind. I mean, it's as good as 500 mics of LSD. I don't advocate that you eat hash for one very simple reason, which I've never figured out a way around, which is it's filthy, you know. It's filthy because it's made by people's hands, and it's hard to figure out a way you could go around that. I suppose baking it in a cookie, maybe that's the raison d'etre of cookies, besides that some people just don't like to chow down on a couple of grams of black hash. But the literature of the 19th century and astonishing people were associated with this. For instance, Louisa May Alcott. She wrote descriptions of little garden parties up the Hudson where these young Victorian women with doctor boyfriends would egg on their young paramours for new thrills, saying, you know, we're tired of canasta and crocheting. Surely you have some little thing in your black bag. And this guy says, well, it just so happens, you know, I have these Lebanese bonbons. And, you know, four paragraphs later, you know, Louisa May Alcott, as you have never known her.
I have a question.
Yes.
Being uninitiated to psychedelics, it's a question of how accessible the weekend's going to be. I mean, does one need to, or to bring that background, that vocabulary, those images?
Well, I think a healthy interest is probably sufficient. The psychedelic experience is always largely very personal. In fact, it's amazing that we have made such bridges as we have to each other. So I think somebody for whom it's all a mystery, being in this group and looking into this, would probably be a pretty good position to be in. You might not understand everything you hear, but you will certainly get a sense of the style of the people who are doing this kind of thing. Well, I might as well represent my position. It's an extreme position. So having said that, you know, you can just reject it. But the interposing of a teacher between ourselves and the mystery is, I think, in most cases in which it's done, unnecessary and counterproductive. If anything, on the spectrum of spiritual options, what psychedelics stand for is the same kind of anarchy that democracy stands for in the spectrum of possible governments. In other words, it's a do-it-yourself theory based on direct experience and use of tools rather than a lineage or a set of techniques that have been passed down for thousands of years. Once you have had a psychedelic experience, a strong and complete one, then you understand how Zen, or just being in a beautiful place, or just having a conversation with a friend how these things are psychedelic. But I don't think you can really understand that until you have been given the benchmark on which to measure these things against. And the notion that there is a secret group of people, inevitably celibate men, who are going to turn you on to the true skinny about reality is, to my mind, nothing more than the old shell game. I mean, the best advice I've ever heard to come out of the Eastern tradition was that if you met the Buddha on the road, you should kill him. You know, finally a bit of candor out of all of this, stuff. But I cheerfully represent a lunatic position, because so many people are saying, and it's said with such fervor by such decent people, that without the guru, without the attachment to the guru, you're just lost, you know? And I'm sure that these are, it isn't all a plot to enrich foreign immigrants. There's a great deal of sincerity in it. But I'm just not sure that they're talking about the same thing. The psychedelic experience is really in a category by itself. I was somewhat excited recently by these machines, like the Synchro Energizer. I don't know how many of you have had experience with these. Well, I just never had any use for machines. But these are interesting. Not when you check into the universe of you and they put you on the canned program, but when you have your fingers on the dial and can smoke a joint and sit down with this thing and twiddle with it, it will go maybe half the distance. But the last half of the distance into the deep revelation has to come. It can't come from a guru and it can't come from a machine, because it is not the property of human beings. It is the Gaia consciousness of the planet. It is the real stuff, the spiritual connection. And the spiritual connection, it can't be faked, or one should accept no substitutes. But I think psychedelic voyaging for that kind of insight is a fairly lonely task. You really are serious about the core of the vision, not the community life of the ashram, not the loving presence of the guru, not the rush of turning other people onto your trip, but the real work, when you turn your back on all that and it's just you and the mystery. The other thing that you have to remember, and I probably have to remember it more than any of you, is that people really are very, very different. We treat ourselves as interchangeable units because our political point of view is largely democratic. So we tend to think of ourselves as just like everyone else. Well, for political purposes, that may have some utility. But when you actually look at people, for instance, some people are 50,000 times more sensitive to a certain odor than other people. They can smell that compound when it's at a concentration 1/50,000th of what it takes for most people to respond to it. Well, similarly, I'm sure for drugs. And why keep it in the chemical realm? Similarly, I'm sure for praise or love or respect. Some people need more, some people need less. So when you set out on the psychedelic path, it isn't that, it's almost as though the classical mystical injunction is reversed. The first thing you have to do when you set out on the psychedelic path is to know yourself, your limits, your capacities, what works for you. people naturally are always wanting to discuss with me their experiences, and I can't believe the things that people do that I wouldn't dream of doing in terms of the size of doses or combinations. You know, people will say, well, we did a little ketamine when the MDMA got going, and then we smoked the DMT, and it was really far out. I'm sure that were I to try and follow you into it, I would just be gibbering. I'm sure that it was far out. I salute the turgor of your ontology to, you know, be able to survive such a thing. And yet, you know, it's obviously working for them, and they're returning with insight. So really, there are no, this path is broad, and you sort of have to make your own way through it, and no one can tell you. That's why it really comes out of these networking situations. Far more important than relating to a distant leader on the subject, Leary or Metzner or me or anybody, it would be much better to have a friend who was moving along the path with you, you could talk to, and then their friends and sort of like that. It's very personal, it's very real. To me, and I guess this is what makes me the fanatic, is it is the only thing that I'm sure is real. I don't want to be a complete pariah in the community, so I grant the possibility that yoga, fasting, diet, exercise, breath control, these things will move psyche around in various ways. But this truly transcendental, alien, information-filled space is, I think, pretty much strictly the product of psychedelic voyaging. And people say, well, you can do it on your own, follow this diet or this teacher. I wouldn't care to do it on my own, thank you. I would be extremely unsettled if any of the things I'm talking to you about began to spontaneously happen. Because they are so far from ordinary reality that I'm quite content to keep them there in that category and to move between them. Shamanism, one way of thinking of it, in fact, in some languages, what the word means is go between, both as someone who goes between two negotiating parties, or someone who goes between two negotiating worlds. It is what we want to be in this world is present, caring, aware, filled with intuition, and in touch with the Tao. The psychedelic thing is more like cutting-edge research in the philosophy department, trying to really understand then how ordinary reality functions, but not trying to function in ordinary reality with that kind of a point of view. I think probably the great, the place where all these paradoxes come together very intensely is with DMT. DMT is, you know, very short acting, 2 to 5 minutes, extremely intense. And there's no way that you can talk about grafting that into ordinary life. I mean, the very idea is ludicrous. It is not a part of ordinary life. It is something which breaks into ordinary life and maybe reorients the compass of ordinary existence, but not to be a part of it. Yes, when I live as I truly wish to live, I smoke grass about 5 hours a day. And I just sit. And I bring books near me in order that should anyone happen upon me, I can claim to be doing something. But
supplied for 6 hours without having to smoke again.
But do you think I would get the rush? Oh, yeah.
No, you get that rush.
No, well, the rush is, there's something to be said for that.
smoke a little bit.
Yeah, well, that would work. That would do it.
Listen, he's a family man. We have to keep him a little bit on the ground.
Well, people, it's amazing. I mean, I have no practice. I don't even jog. I mean, my chiropractor is on me all the time, and I have, but I do manage to make an amazing amount of time for sitting stoned. And then I think all this stuff, and one of the things that really pisses me off in the American scene is the way the media came at us. It was with the people who use drugs are stupid. This is sort of like homosexuals have high-pitched voices kind of argument, you know? A complete travesty, a complete lie, and something that you're hammered on every day. So we have Cheech and Chong and the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers, and we who are heads enjoy this stuff and laugh at it. But I don't think we realize how straight people think, you know, and even scientific reports say, well, if you smoke marijuana, you can't, your memory is destroyed, you have no motivation. Well, I believe that I have an excellent memory, and I also believe that I've smoked more weed probably than... I've smoked more weed than anybody in the house! And so I don't know, it's a slander. I mean, I sometimes worry about how much I smoke, because now you're supposed to worry about anything like that and re-examine it, and some of my dearest friends say, you could do it a little bit less. But I sort of hear it like clods of dirt falling on the coffin, you know? So again, you always, in listening to me, you have to understand it's lunacy that you're hearing, and you're supposed to straighten your life out by taking a position about it, not by believing it. It's sort of like that. Yeah.
They say that people who smoke or take psychedelics escape from reality. To me, the main benefit of the psychedelics is that it shows me that there's a multiplicity of realities, and that this is just one tiny, very relatively unimportant segment of what's really.
That's absolutely true. Lenny Bruce, in Making a Joke, said reality is for people who can't handle drugs. That is absolutely true. That's absolutely true. Because, you know, there's some, it has to do with Darwinian constraints on the organism and so forth and so on, that what is important to the immediate prehension of being is survival stuff. So people allow that to become the defining edge of their reality. And they live in, that's what mundane means. Mundane means close focus, no awareness of the past, no anticipation of the future, no awareness of what's going on to the margins of your own small set of concerns. And then people just shrink and shrink and shrink. The reason I continue smoking weed against a certain amount of advice not to is I've noticed what happens when I stop. When I stop, my worldview begins to shrink. Shrink, shrink, shrink. 72 hours after the last joint, I'm going over my bank books and saying, demanding of Kat, what is our true financial situation? Well, I want to get into what my prepared remarks, but I'll tell you the story about, which is for me the final story on me and grass and why I do it and so forth and so on. When I was, shortly after I met Kat, in 1967, we met in occupied Jerusalem in the Old City, in what was a war zone. I mean, the Israeli-Arab war had just cooled. It was not 5 months in the past. Then I went on to Africa and to the Seychelles which are a group of islands off the coast of East Africa, and I wanted to write a book there. And I had rented a house on almost a cartoon-like desert island. There were only 50 families on this island. They all spoke Creole, which I didn't speak. It was a coconut island, and I had this wonderful little concrete house. And I had this amazing quarter pound of Mombasan black weed that I had scored from the Shushine boys in Mombasa. And it was killer weed. So I got settled into this little desert island house, and I had my portable typewriter, and I had decided that I would keep a schedule of my writing, something I had never done. I would write from 8 o'clock in the morning until 2 in the afternoon every day. So then I looked at this grass there, and I decided that I would... I had just been in Jerusalem, where life had been lived in a cloud of hashish. I mean, we just were into it. So I thought, well, I'm pretty deep into this. I just turned 21. I wasn't as sure of myself as I am now. So I thought, I won't smoke any grass while I write this book. And I nailed the lid over the door of my kitchen and settled into this life of rising every morning, writing for hours. Then in the afternoon, I would take the dogs and walk or swim in the lagoons. And a couple of months passed. And as I moved through the writing of this book, I began to promise the grass to myself as the prize for finishing this book and holding the schedule. So finally, the book was done. And I decided that evening I would get stoned. So I went through my whole afternoon schedule anticipating it. And that evening I cleared away the dishes and I rolled this enormous bomber, moved my chair outside under the palm trees, and the ocean was lapping in. And I smoked two gigantic J's of this stuff. And I was just sitting there just waiting, because I knew, since I hadn't smoked so long, that it was just going to be tremendous. And as I'm waiting for the real thing to hit, there begins to be this funny thing coming in on the side. And I try to look away from it and not notice it. And then my attention goes back to it. Well, finally, I couldn't hold it back, and I just faced this state that was coming over me. And what it was it was the incontrovertible realization that what I had written was complete garbage. Just trash, you know, just sophomoric, megalomaniac, egomaniacal, ungrammatical, poorly conceived, misspelled, tasteless, crass, gratuitously pornographic, and ill-conceived. And I was just like, oh my God, what have I done? So then I just began running around furiously, smoking grass and trying to, and writing, trying to save this thing. And I got out my air tickets and my schedule, and I saw, you have 3 more weeks on this island before you have to go to India and back to San Francisco. And I just started living day and night, smoking dope, writing, and drinking coffee as much as I can. Tried to save this thing. Never could save it. I mean, I will share with you its name to convince you that this was a book that should never have seen the light of day. It was called Crypto Rap, Meta-Electrical Speculations on Culture. Now, if that's not a book which should not be published, I don't know what is. So then I said, okay, take my word for it. No, this was... So then I just saw, you know, it's not for you. Other people may find clarity and a rebirth of their feelings. And people say to me, they say, I felt so good after I quit. Good. Good luck. I appreciate your ascetic example.
Terrence, I've actually found that it's very helpful when I'm writing that I try writing both straight and stoned. And, like, I go back and forth with the two. Like, I write straight, and then I revise it stoned. Or I write it stoned, and I revise it straight. One way or the other, and you go back and forth, and you get alternative perspectives. It's almost like you become two different people, so you can get, like, a second opinion.
Yes, well, I think that's nice. Good, and nice. Sometimes I've made the metaphor that these drugs are like points on a geometric grid, that you can only describe a one-dimensional universe if the only dimension you know is reality. If you have reality and cannabis, then you get a two-dimensional universe. Reality, cannabis, and something else, three points that can be connected, and then suddenly you have a plane figure. And what you're doing is you're creating a map of consciousness that actually takes account of all the consciousness there is. And then you get, when psychoanalysis began, it was basically awake and asleep was the theory of consciousness that Freud inherited. Awake and asleep, what's the big deal? Also, then he showed, you know, states of multiple personality and things like this were not only phenomena of locked wards, that we all had this capacity. We all were to some degree schizophrenic. There were components in the psyche. And then subsequent history of psychoanalysis and therapy has sort of teased that out.
The best vision of the future will win, so says Terrence McKenna. And if you've joined one of our live salons lately, you already know that my vision of the future is one in which artificial intelligence will take over a significant part of your life. And whether it's good or not, I can't say, but that's the vision I think is going to win. So stay tuned. And in keeping with my new minimalist approach to introducing these podcasts, for now at least, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Namaste, my friends.